What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Another movie I liked with Faye Dunaway was 3 Days of the Condor.
The one with Robert Redford when he was young.
Yeah.
You know, I never thought it made sense, though. You know, the way they got together so quick. I mean, romantically.
We might ask the same question about Jack Foley and Karen Sisko in Out of Sight if it weren't for the man who created the characters, Elmore Leonard, who passed away last week at age 87.
We'll honor the man whose work inspired films such as Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, Out of Sight, and many more with our top five Elmore Leonard characters.
Plus a review of The World's End, the latest from Shaun of the Dead director Edgar Wright. That and more.
Seems like just yesterday, Josh, when we met in the trunk of your buddy's car, you escaped from prison, me, a radio host.
Good times, good times. Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including 5 new donors this week, including $5 a month subscriber Eric in Isabella Plains, Australia, a Silver Club donor Melissa in Bellingham, Washington, along with Roderick in Easton, Maryland, Graham in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and Matt S. right here in Chicago, who sends us this nice note.
It was 2 years ago when, working long, tedious hours retouching at a photo studio, I Googled film podcasts. Lo and behold, the first one I clicked was made right here in Chicago, where I've called home for 5 years now. I discovered my inner cinephile as a high school freshman when films such as Pulp Fiction and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas showed me just how weird, creative, and enthralling movies could be. As I got into the heart of my college years, busyness with studies and new chapters of life didn't stop me from loving films, but definitely slowed down the intake of them quite a bit. Discovering Film Spotting felt like a fresh kickstart to my love of the art form. I've listened to a ton of the back catalog and look forward to the new show every week. I've been slacking, but the time has finally come to, yes, pay the dealer. Thanks for doing what you're doing, guys, and keep up the great work.
Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you as well to all of our donors this week and our monthly subscribers, whether it's $2, $5, or $10. And if you can't donate or you're just not ready to commit to the show, one thing you can do to help make a difference is rate us on iTunes. Go to iTunes, find the Film Spotting podcast, and write a nice review or just add a star rating. It just takes a second. You're listening to Film Spotting. Josh and I are going to honor a writer this week by talking about the movies adapted from his books, which I believe has got to be some kind of writer's nightmare.
It's really not fair, is it?
Our apologies to Elmore Leonard there. We'll try to make up for it by sharing our top five Elmore Leonard movie characters later in the show. We'll also see who prevailed in the latest Film Spotting deathmatch poll, pitting the wily tag team of the Coen brothers against the legend, Martin Scorsese.
But first, Adam wisely declined my invitation to hit 12 pubs before reviewing The World's End. Guess this can of cherry coke will have to do.
And we're back. Just like the 5 musketeers.
3 musketeers, innit?
Well, nobody knows how many there were, really, do they?
You know that the 3 musketeers is a fiction, right? Written by Alexander Dumas.
A lot of people are saying that about the Bible these days.
What, that it was written by Alexander Dumas?
Don't be daft, Steve. It was written by Jesus.
Are we there, yeah?
Let's do this!
They haven't seen each other in 20 years.
I'm free to do what I want.
But tonight, they're returning to their hometown to finish the ultimate bar crawl.
This is our chance to finally conquer the Golden Mile.
12 pubs, 12 pints.
And this time, they're going to make it to the last bar, the World's End.
Let's go!
I'm free.
Come on.
What do you recommend?
Beer.
We'll have 5 of those, please. 4 of those and a tap water.
What?
After seeing The World's End last weekend, I stopped at a gas station on my way home. One that's been there forever but was recently remodeled. Everything's clean and neat and state-of-the-art. I swiped my credit card, grabbed the nozzle, and started pumping. And just as I did, music began playing. Like seemingly just from my pump, at the precise moment, the meter started counting.
I think they do that now.
I think they do. It was the first time I experienced it, though, Josh. The song... Monday, Monday. So I'm standing there pumping my gas to the soothing sounds of the mamas and the papas, and I couldn't help but reflect on the movie I just walked out of. A movie about 5 friends, led mostly unwillingly by Simon Pegg's lying, unemployed, alcoholic cad Gary, who set out to relive a night of glory from their youths 20 years prior when they tried and failed to hit all 12 pubs along a stretch called the Golden Mile that culminates at the titular World's End. Along the way, they discover that their not-so-beloved hometown actually has been invaded by aliens who want to, quote, civilize them. Now, what does this have to do with me pumping gas? Well, part of the civilizing process is to turn the imperfect people of Newton Haven into perfect people, to make them mindless, peaceful consumers, incapable of crime or conflict. The new Newton Haven is sort of like Elysium, except with shepherd's pie. Yes, it all seems totally silly, but there I was, calmly buying gas, anesthetized by a machine playing the most ridiculously cheery song ever written. Maybe Peg and his director slash co-writer Edgar Wright are telling us something. The world's end isn't fiction. It's a coded message. The aliens have already invaded. Okay, I'm stretching things a bit. But Wright and Peg, along with co-star Nick Frost, have given us a trio of films now, along with 2004's Shaun of the Dead and 2007's Hot Fuzz, dubbed the Cornetto Trilogy due to the appearance in all three films of a particular ice cream snack, that are completely absurd and yet deliver real moments of truth, whether insights into friendship and romantic relationships or amidst all the chaos and cinematic homages, legitimately powerful emotional moments. I always go back to the cathartic scene between Shaun, played by Peg, and his stepdad, Bill Nye, where they reach some father-son closure just before he turns into one of the walking dead. It's the kind of scene where things get a little dusty in the theater or in your living room when it comes on. And all I could think when I saw it was, how in the hell did they do that? Josh, were there any how in the hell did they do that moments of truth for you in The World's End? More importantly, will you join me in the resistance against our alien captors?
If the aliens have already invaded, I've got another sign for you.
You do.
Everyone loves this movie.
Yeah, it's true.
See?
It's true.
And I would love to be the person to tell you, wake up, people.
We're going to blow the lid right off this thing.
This movie is crap. We're all just buying it. But you know what? This is a really, really fun film. I can't do that. I'm sorry. And as far as those moments, those real powerful moments, of course it has it. I mean, maybe in this trilogy, you could say it dipped a little bit in those with Hot Fuzz, even though that was an enjoyable film. But man, are they back on their game here? And evidence of it is probably that I found the first half, maybe it's probably not the first half, the first third before the invasion unfolds and the movie kind of cracks open. I mean, it's such a jarring, they don't like segue smoothly into this at all, which is part of the fun. But before the crack comes, I was just as enthralled and thought it was just as funny in very different ways in watching these five guys come back together. And that's full of, you know, Wright is a master of this spastic filmmaking style with fast edits and quick moving cameras. And he knows how to make those work. We complain about that technique a lot, but he knows how to make them work. But the first third of this film really relies on underplayed comedy that gets at some of this realism you're talking about and some of this heart. I mean, he makes time for the sigh that each of these four guys give when they receive this invitation from Peg's character. You know, they all do a little variation on it because none of them needs this right now in their lives. And that's so funny. Also, these just little static shots of the four of them sitting around a table after they've agreed, they've launched onto this journey, and they don't know what to say to each other. They don't know why they're there. I mean, there are so many little touches like that which make this film a ton of fun, even before the craziness sets in. And I'll give you one more example, and it's the thing I took away from it the most is Nick Frost's performance. Mm-hmm. Because he's always been good in these films, but he's been the sidekick, and he's the sidekick again here. But he really brings another level to the part of Andy, who was kind of the wingman for Gary in their teen years, willing to do anything, willing to, you know, go booze crazy. And he's, for the most part, embraced adulthood, been fairly successful, you get the sense, at least in terms of business, but we also learn his marriage is struggling. And so this guy brings a sense of, I mean, there's real characterization here. The impeccable comic timing he's always had is there too. I mean, he has some great one-liners and responses to Gary, but he has this sense of sadness around him that he brings with through the entire film. And you asked about those moments where you're wondering, how do they do that? How do they bring these two things together? Probably one of the more entertaining touches and emotional touches, yet also completely ridiculous, is when Andy plunges his fist into the stomach of an adversary. And without giving away details, I'll just say that it's also a very romantic gesture.
Yeah.
And they managed to make that work.
Yeah. They pull off moments like that throughout this entire film. I'm in complete agreement with you. And I think we can touch on Peg and Frost in a little bit more detail, but that was a touch I enjoyed as well. Not just both of their performances, and especially Frost, but also the fact that we're seeing a little bit of a different side to their relationship, because they spend most of this film being adversaries. And you get that a little bit in Hot Fuzz, but that's not because Frost's character wants it that way. He's just kind of a bumbling idiot who Peg can't stand. He wants
much more
to be
the comic role, the purely comic role there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a variation on their buddy pairing, which I really responded to here. But in terms of that question I had for you about real moments of truth or how in the hell did that happen moments, I'm going to get to the one for me. But not only do we get some of those neat insights into friendship here, but just the way Wright and Peg really reflect their understanding of human nature. It's all over this film. The characters here, their capacity for rationalization, the way they all reluctantly fall back into their familiar roles with Gary. You talked about how there's that humor you get from them just kind of sitting around going, what are we doing here and how do we relate to each other now? But eventually they do just kind of fall back into exactly what they did before back in high school, even against their will. That craving for nostalgia, which I think we all feel, the innocence of a simpler time, that desire for familiarity and traditions. We see that here, the way they're resisting growing up. And then, of course, oh, yeah, addiction. This might be one of the best movies I've seen recently that really deals head on with the notion of addiction and alcoholism. And so that leads to, for me, the real how the hell did they do that moment, which I don't want to spoil, but I'll just say that there's a confrontation late in the film between Peg and Frost. And not only do we get some great acting moments from them, totally believable, dramatic moments, everything about that sequence we watch, Josh, could have been lifted straight out of a serious addiction drama, except it happens to be in the climax of this alien invasion movie.
Well, and the example of that, too, is that it's not that this scene is just plopped in. It's interwoven so specifically. And then there are also the metaphors going on so that as this alien invasion is reaching its climax, Gary has that one last pub he just has to get to. So, yeah, what would make you try to run that block through town at risk of your great life to get that last beer? Well, addiction,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So they just weave it in so beautifully.
We had ourselves a little idea.
As you know.
Yeah, we're going to go back to Newton Haven.
Why?
For some unfinished business.
That's a joke, right?
Five guys, 12 pubs, 50 pints.
60 pints.
Oh, steady on you, Alky.
I haven't had a drink for 16 years, Gary.
You must be thirsty then. But we can go back, see the guys, chew the fat, and it'll be just like it always was. Except this time, we are going to finish this thing once and for all.
You have a very selective memory, Gary.
Thanks.
You remember the Friday nights. I remember the Monday mornings.
Yeah, that's why we're going back on a Friday.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from the team of Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost. It's called The World's End. I would even go on to say, Josh, when talking about the truths of this film, even the idea it brings up repeatedly of selective memory is something that gets at this fundamental question of kind of what makes us human. When you really think about it, if you had the choice to be like some of these characters that some of the people from their hometown make, where things would seem to be perfect in your life and simple, but you got to retain memories of your youth or whatever you hang on to as key identifiers from your life, well, wouldn't you maybe choose that? You can see why these characters would. So the fact that they managed to wrap that all up in this alien invasion movie is really quite remarkable. And you mentioned the jarring crack this movie takes. It is true that there's a shift in tone largely where it goes from being this buddy movie or not so buddy movie and a movie that's dealing head on with these notions of addiction and alcoholism that then shifts into kind of this alien movie and much more of an action film. That's true, but at the same time, it didn't feel as abrupt to me as maybe it could have because of the way Edgar Wright has established this world and the way everything works and who these characters are. Because what you see with the guys early on is that most of them, I think, have already basically accepted a life as aliens. They're essentially these robots, which is what they call them early on instead of aliens. But they call them these robots, and that's how they are because they are people who have basically given up on some level. They've kind of resigned themselves to this life of safety and simplicity and complacency and responsibility, which you have on the flip side of that, of course, Gary and everything that he stands for. But that idea, I thought, was something that was introduced already. It was believable to me that we then took on this crazy alien aspect of the film just because I could see that these characters had already kind of embraced it. It maybe wasn't literal, but they were heading there.
I think there's more tension here, though, maybe than what you're talking about between maturity and being able to resist that and live it up as you once wanted to. I think some of the characters, true, especially the Eddie Marson one, I believe, whose family kind of ignores him. He's caught in this life that doesn't represent anything anyone would aspire to. But Andy, the Nick Frost character, is a different vision of maturity. It's something that maybe you would aspire to, even though there are
problems.
He's
really unhappy, though, Josh.
He is unhappy, but he's working through that, and the answer isn't necessarily to relive. He's very much at odds with Gary. They're both twin poles.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is if you look back at the Peg Wright films, all of them have that tension, and it's one thing I really like about them. I mean, it takes a zombie apocalypse for the Peg character in Shaun of the Dead to even consider embracing responsibility, to think about that as an option. And in Hot Fuzz, you know, they have the love of the juvenilia of these Michael Bay movies. That film very much celebrates that juvenilia while also recognizing its limitations. And I think this takes that a step further in trying to come to terms with that. Yet it's by no means a touchy-feely thing about growing up, about Gary becoming better. Because one of the things that I love about the climax is the way they allow, let's just say, Gary's stupidity to win the day, even though at least my emotional journey through the film was going more and more towards Andy, the Nick Frost character, feeling sympathetic to him and like, man, you know, you've got to just get away from Gary or at least hopefully try to help him out. And more like Gary is just this really sad sack, amusing, but you want nothing to do with him in real life.
Yeah.
Then the ending kind of flips that where it is everything that we've been rooting against Gary that is needed to save them. And I just thought that was a great touch because they leave that up in the air. They're not looking for resolution in this tension that's been at the heart of all their films.
Right. And I guess what I was alluding to when you mentioned the twin poles and the conflict, I'm just saying that the central conflict of should we embrace these aliens or not is also inherent in the relationship they have, whether or not we should sort of accept a life of freedom and doing whatever we want like Gary or more complacency and being a little bit more like Andy. You talked about the technique that Edgar Wright uses and how, you know, we come down on a lot of filmmakers who rely on some of these gimmicky things and the quick cutting that's really distracting. But that's exactly what Edgar Wright is not doing here. What he is really showing here is his skill as a filmmaker, a real visual acuity. I think there's a perceptiveness and an inventiveness to what he does with the camera that makes these films really special. And the key example for me, Josh, the one where I really started having a blast with this film, even though I was loving it in a more serious way up to this point, is the scene in the middle of the movie where they have a huge knockdown, drag-out fight with the robots in this pub. It would probably be fun anyway, just because they're fighting robots and a lot of ridiculous things are happening. But it's really what's happening with the camera that makes that scene so special. Because if you watch, yes, there are still a fair number of quick cuts, but the action and the way he captures the action and a lot of the humor that comes from it isn't based on the cutting. It's based on camera movement, the way he follows characters, the design of the entire sequence. You can tell within 15 or 20 seconds that this has been well thought out, well diagrammed, so that you're going to get the most out of it. Nothing is happening just to be chaotic. It's happening because they drew it up this way for a reason. And I really enjoyed watching that camera roam through to the point where it almost feels like there are some almost long takes. And then you realize that, you know, they're broken up by quicker cuts, but there's almost some long takes, at least relative to most action films, because they're just having fun with the camera, but it's all by design and it's really effective.
It's probably the best action scene I've seen this year, actually, which you'd never expect in this film. But that's it. I thought it was a long take, too. I was watching it. At a certain point, I thought, okay, I'm going to watch extra close here, even though it's moving so fast, to see if I can catch a cut, because the way they move the camera is so seamless. And what else is going on, and you touched on it, is in allowing us to move, to just swoop really from each of the guys as they're involved in this fight, it's building characterization in the middle of an outrageous fight scene, because you get to see how each of them individually approaches the fight and how into it or hesitant they are, how they react to their victories or to the, you know, fairly gruesome, even though they're robots, things that are happening. So all of that is built into a wonderful sequence.
So basically what you're saying is it's like the big sequence everyone champions at the end of Avengers, except it's better because it's not a CGI trick.
Because of the characterization?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
yeah,
characterization I mean, of following the characters through the battle the way we do, but, you know, the camera's actually moving and it's not done with special effects. So there's my little jab at Avengers, which I did not plan to get into this review of.
You've
the
just
World's
been waiting
End.
To make that
no.
point.
Well, you know, you made me think of it because everyone did point to that sequence, and that really may have been the only kind of visual moment I did enjoy from Avengers. But as we talk about the filmmaking, specifically what he does with the camera, then what makes this film even more special, why I am responding so strongly to what Edgar Wright does, is that you can apply a lot of the same terms we're using to what he and Peg do with the dialogue, where everything fits together down to a character. At one point, it seems totally random. This character from their past, they look over and he's drinking from a crazy straw. And you think at first that it's just one of those moments where, okay, it's kind of just a visual joke that this really old man is sitting there really dourly drinking at a pub, but he's drinking out of a crazy straw. None of it makes any sense.
Great touch.
It's a great touch. Just on its face, it's a nice gag. But then you find out later that not only is the name Crazy Straw, of course, appropriate in itself kind of a joke, but there's actually a purpose to it. There's a reason why that character is drinking out of the crazy straw. That's the level these guys are working on, and there are so many examples of that kind of stuff in this film. The dialogue, the words they choose to use are carefully chosen. The fact that Gary is constantly battling with his friends about the fact that they think he can never admit when he's wrong about something. And they even get into a semantic argument about it at one point. But that really is what is so entertaining about this film, is that those words matter. The words the characters use with each other matter. So they matter to us as a member of the audience.
The guy with the crazy straw?
Yeah.
Played by David Bradley. I just wanted to get his name in there because he has maybe two scenes,
yeah.
I think.
But he appears in another one of the Cornetto trilogy films, I'm
does
sure.
Does he?
Yeah.
I was just looking, and his face is
one,
familiar from the Harry Potter films,
oh, yeah.
Of course.
That's what I'm thinking of as well.
You'll recognize him from there. And he makes every moment count that he gets in this movie. So he's really, even though he's probably like seventh or eighth on the list of the cast,
right.
You'll remember him right away if you've seen the film. And this goes for all five of the lead characters. They're all really well developed. I think the ones we haven't mentioned yet are Oliver, played by Martin Freeman, and Steven, who's played by Patty Considine. The movie really builds out enough time to give them each their own characters. And you would think that maybe they're setting themselves up for failure there, because how many people do you really want to have to work around? It's just a level of difficulty,
yeah.
By having five leads that you might say, why give yourself that? Well, they're capable of it. And then, of course, they give this cast, who we know we're going to want to see, and they make the most of every little moment they get too. So it's really a rich ensemble performance.
Yeah, it is. And I think maybe part of their strategy is, even though every character does have their own depth to them and gets their own time, Gary's still the ringleader. And he kind of runs the show, and I think they build everyone around him, so it works. The whole film is based on the relationship those characters have to him.
Right.
So that is effective, ultimately, with this film. And we did praise Nick Frost a lot, and I know I said a few words about Simon Pegg, but for me, this is a breakthrough Simon Pegg performance. I mean, I've always liked him as an actor. I think he's been great in these previous films. He's a tremendous comedic talent. But this is a film where he gets to show off some chops, and in those scenes where he has to show off his chops, again, they could get really sort of maudlin, they get overly dramatic. A lesser actor really would have destroyed those scenes where things get a little too serious. They could have instantly ruined everything about the tone of that moment and the whole tone of the film that they'd worked so hard to capture up to that point, and he gets it exactly right.
It's a delicate balance they're going for. Let me ask you this, and I can guess the answer because you seem just overly thrilled with the film, but did the epilogue work for you without getting into details?
I'm actually glad you ask, because I have not wrestled with it enough, but I'll tell you that on first viewing, my initial response was it lowered the film a little bit in my estimation.
Yeah, maybe
I
just
didn't
felt
like
a little unnecessary,
a little
not that there was anything wrong or unfunny in it, but it took us to another place and I kind of liked where we were at.
Yeah, there are some funny touches within it, but maybe just the whole tone there didn't quite work for me, because up to that point, it had been so grounded despite the absurdity of this alien film. And then it just became a little too silly, maybe, in that final closing 5 minutes or so we get. But I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who disagree with us. If you've seen The World's End and agree or disagree with our thoughts on the ending or the film as a whole, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and over at Facebook, facebook.com/filmspotting.
Well, it turns out our film spotting death match, the Coen brothers versus Scorsese, it wasn't much of a death match. Find out who got whomped when we come back with our poll results. Stay with us.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You
don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Cross 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman next week. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free. Across 110th Street, woman trying to catch a trick on the street.
Preserve your democracy. Brothers and sisters, you must come out. Come out to your parents. Come out to your friends, if indeed they are your friends. Come out to your neighbors. Come out to your fellow workers. Once and for all, let's break down the myths and destroy the lies and distortion.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Sean Penn as Harvey Milk in the Gus Van Sant directed biopic Milk, which sets up nicely our poll question this week, Josh, as we look ahead to The Grandmaster, directed by Wong Kar-wai. We plan to review The Grandmaster next week on the show. The true story of Ip Man, the famous kung fu master who taught Bruce Lee his martial art. And in this week's poll, we're going to inquire about what maybe is your favorite biopic. But first, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this.
I hear you whispering, planning on stealing something.
No, ma'am, we're not.
Plan on murdering me in my sleep?
What? No.
That was Mark Wahlberg as Elliot Moore. And Adam, please, at some point, I want to hear you do Mark Wahlberg from Pain and Gain.
What?
The I'm hot, I'm big line. That's your next assignment. Okay. You also heard Betty Buckley as Mrs. Jones. That was from The Happening. 2008, written, directed by who else but M. Night Shyamalan.
I think you need to go back and redo what you just said, Josh, but in the voice of Betty Buckley as Mrs. Jones. That's just too much fun.
I was accused of too many S's, too much hissing, apparently.
Oh, okay.
Did you see that?
No,
yeah,
I thought you were right on with your depiction of Mrs. Jones. And all I can say about the dearth of entries we received to The Happening this week is
you're encouraged?
No. I can't believe how few we got. And I guess, yes, maybe I am actually encouraged.
You should feel better about our listeners.
Because that means that our listeners either just didn't recognize it or maybe they've managed to avoid The Happening, which was, if I remember correctly, the worst film of 2008. Yes, according to Film Spotting.
Okay.
It was that bad.
I could see
it
that.
It was my least favorite film of that year. We got this thought from Chris Massa in Pittsburgh, PA. He said, as you said, the obvious tie-in with the top five nature movies you did last week was that this is very much a movie about nature. Even more to the point, it's a movie about Mark Wahlberg and company trying to run away from nature. If this isn't a bad premise for a thriller, I don't know what is. But here's another tie-in Chris gives us.
Both Prince Avalanche and The Happening are the works of directors who at one time could seemingly do no wrong. They were young, innovative, and had found devoted followers. Gradually, both directors started making some questionable directing decisions, even to the point of making movies that were genuinely awful. Then word got out that they were making new movies, movies that were speculated to be a return to form. And here the similarities end, for while David Gordon Green may have made a really good movie with Prince Avalanche, The Happening turned out to be another giant turd from the mind of M. Night Shyamalan. Oh, well.
Eric Grebner in Decatur, Illinois, describes The Happening as one of the worst films of all time about nature causing humans to run over themselves with lawnmowers or something. What? No. It's not possible that your performance could be an immense improvement over the original, but it has happened.
Yeah. What was the other one we did? Armageddon we improved, too, I believe.
We maybe did improve
Armageddon. So it takes a certain kind of movie. Ben Hayworth from Austin, Texas, wrote in to say, thank God, though, you picked a scene from The Happening and not The Last Airbender. The Happening may be bad, but The Last Airbender should be brought up for crimes against humanity.
How can that be possible? What? No.
Right.
It's not possible that there is a movie.
You could just use that everywhere, can't you?
You really can. That there is a movie worse than The Happening.
It's kind of hard to imagine.
I don't buy it. Well, if you want to hear that scene, plus our top five nature movies and our review of David Gordon Green's latest film, Prince Avalanche, you can find that show at filmspotting.net or get it via iTunes. We did also recommend Fruitvale Station, the new Joe Swanberg film, Drinking Buddies, and The Act of Killing didn't make it into our show, but that new documentary, really powerful, visceral stuff that we both highly recommend. We did share that as a separate podcast. So if you want to hear our discussion on The Act of Killing, that too can be found at filmspotting.net or accessed via iTunes. Josh, as I said, not many entries this week. The pickings are slim, but go ahead, reach in and give us this week's winner.
Well, the winner and the loser, because this means he saw The Happening, would be Chris Zoyce from Chicago.
Congratulations, Chris. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Come down.
Horace, when the fellow's dead, the play is over. Say what you have to say with speed and put the audience out of their misery.
Another fairly brief scene here for Massacre Theater, though not quite as quick as the one from The Happening.
Or as horribly bad.
No, not at all. Massacre Theater is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information is at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
And new on Fandor this week, if you go over and check out their collection, they are now offering short films by the Duplass brothers, which I believe up to this point were unavailable. The titles include The Intervention, This Is John, and Scrapple. So if you are a fan of the work of Jay and Mark Duplass, as I generally am, you can check out some of their very early work, all films around 10 to 15 minutes long, over at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Josh, you've got the meaty role this week.
You want me to take the meaty role?
Yeah, I do. I'm not going to say anything here to give away what the tie-in is to this week's show. Our listeners will certainly come up with many that we didn't think of, but I know there are multiple tie-ins to what we're discussing on this week's show. So are you ready?
All right, let's do it.
I'm going to give you the action and action.
I know why you lost your faith. How could holiness exist if your wife can be taken away from you and the children? I've always said that God can kiss my ass. But I just changed my lifetime tune about 30 minutes ago because I know that whatever is out there trying to get in is pure evil straight from hell. And if there's a hell and those sons of bitches are from it, then there has got to be a heaven, Jacob. There's got to be. So which are you? Are you a faithless preacher or are you a mean mother effing servant of God?
I'm a mean servant of God. And scene.
I thought you were going to break into song there.
I just might. I didn't get to during our Holy Grail rendition a few weeks ago, so I'm going to make up for that now. And I just have to say that the actor you're portraying has never emoted that much in his life.
Did I overdo it?
Yeah, you overdid
it. I was trying to go down with it. But.
Just a little bit.
Oh, well.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, September 3rd. I'm predicting another dearth of entries, but I do think we'll probably get more than The Happening. We'll see.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Call it.
Call it.
Yes.
For what?
Just call it.
Well, we need to know what we're calling it for here.
You need to call it. I can't call it for you.
Well, it wouldn't be fair.
I didn't put nothing up.
Yes, you did. You've been putting it up your whole life. You just didn't know it.
Call it, friendo. You gotta love Javier Bardem as Anton Chigurh and Gene Jones as the gas station proprietor there from the Coen Brothers film No Country for Old Men. For the sake of our poll question results that we're about to get into, though, Josh, it's Film Spotting as Anton Chigurh and you, the listeners, as the gas station proprietor. We are going to share the results of our deathmatch poll. We asked you last week, looking ahead to our fall movie preview, which, yes, we've pushed back due to the untimely death, unfortunately. Well, I guess he did live to be 87. He had quite a life. But unfortunately, the passing of Elmore Leonard did give us an opportunity to share our top five Elmore Leonard characters, which we'll get to here in a bit on the show. We have pushed back our fall movie preview to next week. We asked you simply last week, though, which of these fall movies, if you could only see one, would you go to? Your choices were Inside Llewyn Davis, the new film from the Coen Brothers. It opens wide around Christmas time. Or The Wolf of Wall Street, the new Martin Scorsese film starring Leonardo DiCaprio that opens mid-November. How did it come out, Josh?
Despite the star power of DiCaprio, only 35% of the people voted for The Wolf of Wall Street. 65% for Llewyn Davis.
Yeah, well, let's hear from the voters. Josh, Max O'Connell in Syracuse, New York says, "You monsters." That's it. He saw the results and he just said, "You monsters." I guess we have to decide whether or not that's us or the listeners for giving Scorsese such a thorough beating.
Maybe if he saw the results, that's what he was referring to.
I'm guessing, yeah.
Lady Cade said, "I love Marty. I'm curious as to what he'll have to say about the 80s on Wall Street. I lived the 80s on Wall Street, but at this point, I simply must see every and anything the Coens think they want to make, and they got my vote."
Okay, a fairly convincing argument. We go to Eric, who says, "Look, I'll just say it. The Coens are better filmmakers than Scorsese. Sorry, it's science."
Oh, science. He's calling on science.
Maybe
well,
a little less
well,
convincing of an argument.
Todd Stevens from Chicago said, "Based on the trailers, Wolf of Wall Street does not seem to prominently feature a cat. I vote for the movie that prominently features a cat."
Just when you thought you couldn't get an even less convincing argument, there's Todd here in Chicago. Thank you. Yes, Oscar Isaac, the main character in Inside Llewyn Davis. From the trailer, from what I've heard, because, of course, I've tried to avoid it, but there's apparently a prominent cat feature.
A very compelling cat, apparently.
Okay, I guess so. I'll take your word for it, Todd. Peter R. says, "The Wolf of Wall Street looks like a mashup of Wall Street and Goodfellas with Scorsese's signature breaking the fourth wall and garish violence. Sorry, it's not even close. I'm no folky, but I'd rather watch Oscar Isaac navigate Greenwich Village and Points Beyond with a cat in tow, there it is again, than bear witness to Leo throwing lobsters, Benjamins, and Fabergé eggs at the FBI for 2 hours. It's not even close," he says, Josh.
We did hear from some people who voted for Scorsese, including Edwin Arnauden from Asheville, North Carolina. "I'm interested in Inside Llewyn Davis's story over The Wolf of Wall Street," he says, "but I'm more intrigued by Scorsese's directorial style than the Coens. When Scorsese is on his game, he elevates the material to greatness, even if the writing is so-so."
Terrell Rice on the same page as Edwin says, "Scorsese can always elevate a bad screenplay into something good. The Coens just don't have that same effect. I couldn't even defend The Lady Killers because it was so terrible. Also, I can be biased towards Scorsese since I named my cat Scorsese."
What's with the cats?
There it is again. We may need to bring a cat into the studio. We need to film spot
I'm
a cat.
I'm allergic.
Even better.
All right. Andy Friedman from Philadelphia said, "The Coen brothers have an incredible career behind them and still one ahead of them, I'm sure. But with Scorsese, who knows how many more classics he's got left at his age. This one seems to be in line with the fast-paced and humorous yet shocking absurdity of The Departed and has Scorsese working with actors he never has before. I can't wait to see what he gets out of Matthew McConaughey and Jonah Hill. Inside Llewyn Davis will probably be fantastic as well, but I am less enticed."
Okay, so the argument that who knows how many masterpieces or who knows how many films, period, we're going to get from Scorsese.
It's kind of grim.
It is kind of grim, but a fairly compelling one. Thank you, Andy, for that. We close with this from Kevin in Boynton Beach, Florida, who acknowledges it's off topic. He's dusting off the "why do you call it top five memorial list" file.
Boy.
It should be honorary list. He says, "I'm curious as to why these polls are called death matches and not Sophie's Choices. I mean, the films aren't actually fighting to the death. We're making a difficult choice. Just wondering."
Thanks, Kevin. He just ignited an email thread.
No.
That will haunt me for weeks.
No. I actually did not respond because I'm going to do it here on the show. No, I've never thought about it, but of course...
Well, here we go.
We don't have anybody named Sophie making a choice either, Kevin, so don't be so literal.
This is true.
One person walked out of this cage alive, and it was the Coen brothers in this case, so I think we're sticking with the death matches, but thank you. Thank you for caring about the semantics of our show. I really do appreciate it. That brings us to this week's poll question. As we teased at the top of this segment, we're looking ahead to the Grandmaster, Wong Kar-wai's latest film, and his biopic, if you will, of Ip Man. That got us thinking about biopics in general, which might be, Josh, one of the more maligned cinematic genres. It's very rare that you hear a film critic, it certainly hasn't happened on this show.
Yeah, I don't care for him too much.
Say, biopics are great. They're one of my favorites. So we do malign them quite a bit, and maybe we can get at why, or we can think about that as we look to some of the better biopics. So what we've done here is limited this question to biopics directed by filmmakers who are contemporaries of Wong Kar-wai. So these are all choices that come from directors who were born around the same time in the 50s or around the 50s and made their first films around the 80s. So with that in mind, which of these films made by a contemporary of Wong Kar-wai is your favorite?
An Angel at My Table or Bright Star. That's going to be either one of those by Jane Campion.
Yep.
You can vote for. Okay. Carlos from Olivier Assayas. Che from Steven Soderbergh. I'm Not There from Todd Haynes. Spike Lee's Malcolm X. Gus Van Sant's Milk. Or David Fincher's The Social Network.
A lot of great films there. A lot of great films there. It's a tough choice. And we're going to hold off, Josh.
Are we holding off?
Our pick? Yeah. Let's see what
I have an other in
with.
Mind
oh,
I might
do?
End up going with.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Throw it out there.
Now? Yeah, Michael Mann's Ali. Would he fall within the
contemporary?
I think he would.
I think he probably would.
It's,
probably
it's a biopic I really like. So.
Okay. Well, there's no other here, so
I don't know if it would. Well, there we go. That's okay, because there's another one on the list I really like, too.
Okay. Well, we'll find out what that is next week on the show. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, you can get access to the Film Spotting bonus content. So if you have the Film Spotting iPhone app or Android app or Windows 8 phone app, you can get that little extra bit of audio. And this week, we're going to respond to an email we got from a listener named Theo in Boise, Idaho. He wants to know if 2013 is actually the year of the disappointing film. He's got several nominees for that category, and we'll also share some of your thoughts on our recent top five dangerous missions. Eleanor in Philadelphia has a particularly good one we missed. So we'll get into all that in our bonus content. Again, for more info about that, just go to filmspotting.net and click on apps. Josh, we also plugged this last week, but as it is this weekend and it's coming up, I wanted to promote it one more time because I just love this trilogy of films so much. As we're talking about The World's End and that Cornetto trilogy, we might as well bring up one more time the Before trilogy from Richard Linklater, Ethan Hawke, and Julie Delpy. You could watch all three movies back to back to back this weekend. Depending on when you're listening, you have some times to go to those screenings at the Siskel Film Center starting on August 31st. Saturday, Sunday, and then Wednesday during the week.
That's really going to accentuate one of the more shallow things we do with these movies, which is compare how Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy age.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we talk about that.
You can't help it. And I actually think that's
seeing them back to back to back.
Part of the genius
though,
of the film.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course. Yeah.
We grow
it's a
old,
fun part
we watch
of it.
Them grow old.
But you know what I mean? Like seeing it that directly after each other. It'll be interesting. No one wants to fast forward 10 years of their life, you know, with a little popcorn break in between.
You're right. And especially if you watch for the first time or rewatch Before Sunset in preparation for your screening of Before Midnight, as I did and many listeners did as well, then you really are seeing Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as they were 10 years ago,
right,
9 years
right.
ago. And then you go watch them in this new film and it does jar you. It does jar you and you just can't help that. So that's an interesting point, Josh. Finally, more information you can get at filmspotting.net. We've been talking for some time now about the Korean Auteurs Marathon. Six films, one from each of six well-known, well-regarded Korean auteurs. That marathon, we're not giving you much time unless you follow us on Twitter or over at Letterboxd, which we encourage you to
do. We've been talking about
it
for a while there.
We've been talking about it, but we haven't given you a start date or really given you the lineup yet. Go to filmspotting.net, click on marathons for the entire lineup. That will also take you to a page we set up, a list I set up over at letterboxd.com, where you can see all the movies we considered, including the six we settled on. And if you click on the Read Notes button, it will tell you where these films are available. So whether it's Netflix Instant or Netflix DVD or Amazon or iTunes, actually four of the six films we're watching are available via streaming.
So that'll make it easier for
people. It should make it easy for people to follow along. I love, Josh, the one aspect to this by building this up so long now, longer than most of our other marathons and talking about as much as we have, is that there seems to genuinely be a ton of interest out there. I think we're going to get the most participation we've had with any marathon. It seems to be a blind spot for a lot of our listeners. So we do encourage you to participate. You can get all that information again at filmspotting.net. Just click on marathons. But we're going to dive into the first film next week. It's Three Iron from 2005, directed by Kim Ki-do.
Chili Palmer, Karen Sisko, Bobby Shaye. The late novelist Elmore Leonard sure had a knack for naming characters. Which screen incarnations are among our favorites? The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Hello there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. This is Allison Wilmore from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And this week on the show, Matt Singer and I lick each other's used tissues as we review Brandon Cronenberg's Antiviral, which is now streaming on Netflix.
Inspired by Antiviral, we'll also recommend some other body horror films available online for streaming or rental. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
This is Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
If I have several bad guys and I only want to end up with one of them, then I have to decide which one I want in the end. And it's normally the one who is the most interesting talker.
You're listening to Film Spotting. It's time for this week's Top 5. We're going to pay tribute to the recently departed great writer, Elmore Leonard, who died last week at the age of 87. You just heard him there in a 2004 interview with NPR's Brian Naylor. Seemed like a very appropriate quote to transition into this tribute, Josh, as when you think about Elmore Leonard, of course, you think about the great writing and you think about the dialogue and his great talkers. We get so many great talkers. I think you're going to see that probably come up at least once or twice as we go through our list.
And you think about the bad guys. I like that. That's true. Says, if I have several bad guys, because he always had great bad guys. So he probably had to make that choice all the time.
Yeah. So how did you approach this list? Of course, he's a writer who has had several of his works adapted into films. We have not, by any stretch of the imagination, seen every single one of them, but no. I feel like we've
seen enough of them. We tried to play a little catch-up.
Yeah, we did play a little bit of catch-up, each of us on our own, and I think we've seen enough of them to try to hit a lot of the big ones anyway.
We're definitely familiar with the films that most people are familiar with of his. That was during the 1990s when they just had this string of a handful of great movies, Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, and Out of Sight, adapted from his works. But, you know, he was writing for so long, and he actually started out in Westerns. Some of his first screen credits were for some of these Westerns, 310 to Yuma, the original one, and Hombre, both of which I think are probably going to make our list. So all in all, you know, his first published novel was in 1953, and then his last was just last year. So that's 60 years of beloved genre fiction that he was putting out there. So yeah, a wealth of material to pick from. My number five comes from the film Jackie Brown, which is a little bit of a variation on the original, the Tarantino film. But this character is true to the book. And not only that, he was also in Elmore Leonard's Out of Sight. It's Ray Nicolette, played by Michael Keaton. No, it's not a cheat. I'm going to concentrate on Jackie Brown.
Okay.
So relax. Nicolette is an ATF agent who intercepts Jackie when she's smuggling cash. And then he cuts a deal with her to help nab the gun runner that she does work for. And it really took an Elmore Leonard character to bring back the madness of Michael Keaton, that unpredictability that's kind of been his calling card, I think. And you can sense that in just a couple of scenes that he gets here, including the interrogation scene with Jackie. He's very squirrely. He's very jumpy. And watching it again, I noticed something very odd at the beginning of it. He very obviously adjusts his crotch for some reason.
Yeah.
Didn't notice that before.
You've no idea what $50,000. You're clueless about the money, right? You have no idea what the 50 grand
is. I have no idea.
You have no idea. You don't know. It could have gone here. Could have gone there. You don't know.
I know nothing. Not a clue. I don't have an idea where the motherfucking money is.
Not even a little idea, maybe.
Not even a little tiny motherfucking idea.
Just a polygraph on.
Yeah, if a motherfucker make you happy. Yeah, put it right there. I'll do it.
What's fun about this scene, too, is that he goes back and forth from good cop to bad cop. It's like it's a split personality thing that he's doing, which Keaton kind of did in a lot of his performances. And it also ends on this really touching, genuine note of concern.
I sure hope you didn't do anything stupid, Jackie.
And the impressive thing, too, is that he's doing all of this against a powerhouse performance from Pam Grier in that very scene. I'll get to her more later.
I do love Ray Nicolette, but it does raise something I hadn't thought about at all until you just mentioned it, Josh, which is even though the characters, like with most great characters, are so tied to the performers playing them, I wonder if we both could have our exact same top five lists if these characters were played by different people. But that's one for me that the only way I probably really love Ray Nicolette is because it's played by Michael Keaton.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
You know,
there.
And it's not just because I really like Michael Keaton as an actor and he gives a good performance, but because there was something just so fun about seeing Michael Keaton back on screen. My favorite line from the movie Out of Sight probably comes from an interaction with Ray Nicolette when Dennis Farina, another great character, great actor, playing Jennifer Lopez's father, says to him as he walks up wearing his shirt that says FBI on it, "Hey, Ray, do you do you ever wear one that says undercover? And it really does set Michael Keaton back. It's such a great line. Good pick. Before I get to my top five, just a quick note. I do want to plug our friends over at The Dissolve. They had a great conversation between their writers. They called it Appreciating Elmore Leonard, and they just kind of went back and forth over some email. Noel and Tasha, Nathan Rabin, Matt Singer was in there, Scott Tobias and Keith Phipps, of course, and Noel Murray had this line about Leonard. His villains were likable. His heroes were flawed. I think that sums it up well. And Tasha had this gem. I love the casual cool of Out of Sight and Jackie Brown, particularly the way the former handles the romance between Clooney and Lopez, who seem to decide on first glance that of course they're going to have sex, but they still want to play out the chase because knowing the inevitable outcome doesn't make the process any less fun.
That's
and that
good.
Not only is really well said, but it does get at to this notion of talking. That's what those two characters do so well. And they're going to talk about it and they're going to build out the suspense as much as they can, even though they know the outcome's inevitable. I think Tasha's dead on, and we will link to that article in the notes for this show over at filmspotting.net if you want to seek it out. My number five pick, I guess, is a cheat, but I just couldn't help it because I think the character and the performance are both so good. It's the one pick on my list, Josh, where the character did not originally emanate from the Elmore Leonard source material, but you know what? This film is definitely seen as an Elmore Leonard movie, and this character is such a great prototypical Elmore Leonard character that I had to include her. It's Jessie from the 1967 Western Hombre, played by Diane Cilento, the former Mrs. Sean Connery. This is a movie directed by Martin Ritt, who also directed Paul Newman, the star of this movie, in the film Hud. And it's hard not to go with John Russell. It's hard not to pick Paul Newman here just because he's a pretty fascinating, enigmatic character, kind of the classic Newman role, an anti-hero. He's distant, he's stoic, but he's also principled, and the prejudice against him because of his Apache background comes into play as he's one of the people journeying on a long trip on this stagecoach, along with Jesse and other people trying to get out of their little town and start a new life. They get held up along the way by some outlaws. I do think that the John Russell character fits into a certain Leonard hero type that I think we'll get into a little bit more later, but the standout character really is Jessie, and you see a little bit of Anne Margaret in her from Rio Bravo, for example, but this is more of a revisionist Western, certainly, than what we get in Rio Bravo. She's a really tough woman. She says what's on her mind. She challenges the sexual politics of the day. At one point, she says openly to two other women that she enjoys men. She enjoys sleeping with men, and she doesn't really hide it or is worried about her reputation. At the same time, she's practical enough to realize her limited options. And one of my favorite scenes in the movie, Josh, is when she goes and proposes marriage to a man she's been shacking up with, really just because she's being evicted from the hotel that she runs and needs a place to go. So that could, of course, be seen as needy and desperate, and I suppose not too much of a feminist move.
That's not how she plays it.
But that's
though.
Not how she plays no. it. And she really is the person assuming a position of power in that scene, and she has that position largely throughout the entire film.
Anybody in there?
Just one.
Got something to say, and I just assumed nobody heard it.
Why? Something wrong?
Russell is selling the house. I'm high and dry.
Well, no, that's kind of sudden, eh?
Well, it's his house. My luck.
Well, if you're hurting for money, Jess, I can let you have a little.
You can let me have more than that, Frank.
Like what?
You can make an honest woman out of me.
Oh, come on, Jess. You're already that.
Now, don't hedge. I need an answer. You appear to be it.
Well, that's a hell of a romantic way of looking at it.
Well, you could do a whole lot worse.
I think Hombre's a really good movie, probably underseen as it was not seen by me before I started preparing for this list, but a good film, and she's fantastic in it. Jessie, my number five.
I'm glad you're sneaking her in because I had never heard of Diane Cilento before, to be honest with you. And boy, what a performance. And she does seem to be such the prototypical Leonard character.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it when I realized she wasn't in the book. I mean, the lines they give her, too, including the one you talked about, the one about I've been wedded, I've been bedded, I've been loved. I mean, she has so many wonderful moments. She's the standout in the picture, definitely deserving. My number four also comes from Hombre, and it's Cicero Grimes, played by Richard Boone. He is one of the villains, the lead villain, and Leonard characters, especially the villains, they tend to get great entrances. They know how to make an entrance, and Boone gets one here.
Cicero Grimes.
Yes, sir?
Well, write it down, boy, for the coach out front.
His name is Frank Braden in the novel for the purists. They do change that, too. So a lot of changing going on with Hombre. The main plot here does involve the stagecoach ride, and Grimes makes his entrance by waltzing into the station, and he demands a ticket on the stagecoach. He's told it's full. Then he just bullies one of the people there. It's an ex-soldier, actually, of all the people you think you couldn't bully. It's this ex-soldier into just giving him his ticket, even though this poor guy, he's heading home to get married, I believe. And everyone else, they just helplessly watch.
You wearing a gun. You better get one.
Well, you can't just threaten a man like that. There are witnesses here seeing you threaten me.
They heard you call me a dirty name.
I never called you anything.
And even if they didn't, I did.
I didn't say a word.
Now, friend, I'm going to step out into the street here. And if you don't come out in about 1 minute, I'm going to have to come back in here.
Now, Boone has, he's a big guy, and he's got this pug face. He's really imposing, and he uses that physicality. But, of course, being a Leonard character, he's also verbally insinuating, especially once they get in the interiors of that claustrophobic stagecoach. Now, I probably don't want to reveal exactly how Grimes plays a role in the plot because there's a little bit of deception there. But check it out for yourself because, as you said, Hombre is worth tracking down. And right now it's actually on Netflix Instant, so
yeah, it
easily
is.
Viewable.
That's how we both saw it. And that scene is going to come up again later in this top five. Maybe not any of those characters for my list, but that scene is going to come up again. For my number four Elmore Leonard character, this one does come from one of his stories, and I'm going with Charlie Prince from 310 to Yuma. I have seen the original Western version, but I'm going with the 2007 remake, actually, in this case, because of Ben Foster's portrayal of Charlie Prince. He's the sidekick to Ben Wade, played by Russell Crowe, the leader of this gang. Christian Bale's character is a guy who tries to make some extra money by getting him on the train to Yuma, getting him to prison, right, is the crux of the film. Charlie Prince is there to try to stop him and rescue the guy he works with. And this performance actually made my top five supporting actors of the year 2007 because I really love what Ben Foster brings to the character. There's a little bit of homoeroticism to it, without a doubt. And look, the Western genre is full of homoeroticism, so it kind of made sense. But you watch the way Charlie Prince regards Ben Wade, and it's hard not to see that maybe he's got more than just affection for his boss. There may be some stronger feelings there. There's a little bit of a feminine quality, too, to Ben Foster. And that makes sense because then you recognize that he has to compensate for kind of his soft looks by being a certifiable homicidal maniac, which is what he is in this movie. He will stop at nothing to get what he wants and use whatever excuse he needs. He doesn't even need one to shoot you down. I think about the scene in particular with Ben Foster where there's a shootout in a town and he's got a lot of men on his side. There's some other people against him. Ben Wade is there as well as Christian Bale's character. And he's just walking down the street with all these bullets whizzing around him. He's just not afraid. He really does think he's invincible. He's very scary, but he's charismatic. He's shouting commands. He is really thrilling to watch. And you just know that anytime that Charlie Prince character comes on screen, he's going to wreak some havoc.
Hey! Hey! Not the blockhead! The rancher, you dumb s***! The rancher!
And at the same time, Josh, what I really love about the character is that his whole life, as I suggested, is in service of one thing. He's on a mission to save Ben Wade. Whatever his reasons are, that's all he cares about. That's his job. That's his purpose in life. And it's something I actually asked Ben Foster about a few years ago when he was here with Oren Moverman, the director of the movie The Messenger. And here's what he had to say about playing the Charlie Prince character.
In terms of rationalizing it, in my mind, this is a guy that if you live and die out in the desert terrain, and the way that you survive is shooting first, and that you have someone that you love and you will do anything to protect them, if you start thinking about your family, and if that's your family, it starts making sense.
Yeah. Makes choices a little easier for you, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Yeah. So as you heard there, he found this a pretty easy role to play in the sense that he knew at all times what his character's motivation was, and he went after it, and I really do love that performance.
That probably falls in the category of the psychopathic villain that,
yes,
you know, Leonard had those, but he also has a lot of these villains who are scary and at the same time funny, and it's that balance, and that's what my number three has. It's Bo Catlett, played by Delroy Lindo, in Get Shorty. He plays this drug dealer who becomes a movie investor. And of course, Get Shorty, you know, part of the joke. It's a movie joke at the expense of movies. So the business is populated by crooks. Here are real crooks. It takes no real talent to make a movie. All these sorts of things are played with. And Bo Catlett, even though he's this imposing drug dealer, also gets one of the best comic scenes in which he and John Travolta's Chili Palmer talk about the simplicity of screenwriting.
So what do you think of the script?
Well, the first thing that's got to go is the title. I mean, this writer's name, Murray Saffron, would be better than Lovejoy.
Now, I'm with you on that one. You know what I'm thinking? Why don't you and I, we sit down, we write the script over where it needs it.
You could write one of these.
There's nothing to it. All you do, you get an idea, you set down what you want to say on paper. Then you hire somebody else to fill in the commas and shit where they belong, if you're not positive yourself. Maybe fix up the spelling where you have some tricky words. Although, I've seen some scripts, I know the words weren't spelled right. There was hardly any commas in it at all.
You know, Delroy Lindo, he's an actor who's usually good in whatever he does, but he also feels like he's one of those actors who's just ready-made for an Elmore Leonard character.
Yeah, well, I will see you, your scary but funny Bo Catlett, and raise you the scariest but funniest Elmore Leonard character I could think of. That's Ordell Roby from Jackie Brown, played by Samuel L. Jackson. This is the 1997 Quentin Tarantino film based on the 1992 Leonard novel Rum Punch. He's a gun smuggler. He's also into drugs and various other devices, anything he can do to make a buck. He uses the lead character, Jackie, to smuggle money from Mexico into the U.S. And this guy really is that villain that gets back to the quote that started off this segment, where he's the most entertaining talker in the film. He's crazy and scary and has no remorse, just like Charlie Prince, my previous pick. But he's got that sharp tongue and a sense of humor like Jesse has, even from Hombre. He is the devil. He is the guy that's going to get in your door if he wants to get in. He will convince you to open it up for him. He convinces poor Beaumont, Chris Tucker, to get inside the trunk of a car because he just has that kind of personality and the ability to be intimidating and be scary, but when he needs to put you at ease, to make you really comfortable when he needs to get whatever he wants. Of course, the key scene, the really memorable one for me, though, is not the Beaumont scene. It's actually the one where he goes to Jackie's house and he's waiting out for her after she's been arrested. I don't know how much we can play of this on the radio. Certainly there are going to be a lot of bleeps, but it's an amazing scene. And I love it for so many reasons, but mainly because of how it puts this scary character, Ordell, in a vulnerable position, which we haven't seen him in up to this point.
I'm going to unload both of these motherfuckers if you don't do what I tell you to do. You understand what I'm saying?
Jackie, stop acting crazy.
Do you understand what the fuck I'm saying?
Yeah, woman, damn.
Now sit your ass down on that sofa.
See? Police start fucking with your mind. They start pitting black against black. That's how they do. You know, been doing it since the beginning.
Shut your raggedy ass up and sit the fuck down. And put your hands behind your head.
Come on, this getting silly now.
Oh, silly?
Of course, if we're going to have a top five about Elmore Leonard, we have to mention Quentin Tarantino, not just through a pick like Jackie Brown, but just in terms of acknowledging Tarantino has said that Elmore Leonard was the biggest influence on him in terms of dialogue. And watching some of Elmore Leonard's other films that I hadn't seen before in preparation for this list, Josh, I did recognize how much of that influence was on Tarantino. And the one way I'll throw it in particular is the way so many characters in Elmore Leonard's films and in his stories communicate by telling stories. They communicate through parables. A character says something very matter-of-fact. The other character responds with something like,
launches them into a story.
You know,
yeah.
Do you know how cucumbers are made?
Yeah.
And it doesn't really seem to make a whole lot of sense. That's from The Big Bounce, the original Big Bounce. But that is something that Tarantino obviously makes great use of in his films. I do really like Jackie Brown, and I love the Ordell Roby character.
Off the top of your head, would you say this is the scariest Samuel L. Jackson character?
Maybe.
I think it might be for me. Yeah, I'd have to look more closely, but
right.
From what I'm remembering, this guy's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely put it more on the scary end, the funny end, but he does have some good lines. My number two comes from Jackie Brown as well. It is Jackie Brown. I know that she's Jackie Burke in the novel. I know that she's white in the novel, but this book planted enough of a seed in Quentin Tarantino's brain to give us his best movie and a magnificent Pam Grier performance that I did want to recognize.
All right. We're on. Might be a little black, man.
Would you like to hear some music?
Sure.
Cool. You know, I couldn't wait to get home last night and wash the gel out of my hair.
Looks nice.
Thanks.
You never got into the whole CD revolution?
Oh, I got a few, but I can't afford to start all over again. I mean, I've invested too much time and money in my albums.
Yeah, but you can't get new stuff on records.
I don't get new stuff that often.
It's probably Greer and Robert Forster's tentative grown-up romance that's what brings some full-fledged humanity into Tarantino's world, which, you know, otherwise it's admittedly entertaining, but I find sometimes can be a little bit empty. Not so here. Greer is so good in the quiet scenes, just the one of her talking to Forster about the Delphonics, but she does get that moment you referenced where Tarantino lets her just go blaxploitation badass, back to what we remember her from in her early films. So Jackie Brown, it does work not only as a tribute to Greer, but it's really a culmination of her entire groundbreaking career, and if it took a book from Elmore Leonard to bring that about, so be it.
Well, we're going to go from Quentin Tarantino to Steven Soderbergh for My Number Two. It is a character from Out of Sight, and yes, Film Spotting listeners, Out of Sight is in the Film Spotting pantheon. We usually don't make it eligible for these lists, but for a special tribute like this to Elmore Leonard, we are going to go ahead and include the pantheon. And I frankly could have picked all five of my favorite characters probably from this film, but I'm going with this one, Glenn Michaels, played by Steve Zahn, who I do think fits a certain Elmore Leonard type we see in his movies. You get the scary but fast-talking, funny villain we've talked about. We get the cool hero, which we'll get to a little bit more in a second. But we also get the fool. We get a character like Leo in 52 Pickup, Ray Barboni, and Get Shorty, played by Dennis Farina. The bad guy who just doesn't understand how to play the game. And I think Zahn's really funny here. I almost want to pick him. I know you'd call me a cheater, but I almost wanted to pick him and Snoopy Miller, Don Cheadle, together, because when they're together on screen, those are my favorite scenes. And Out of Sight, I think about the scene where they're driving down the road when they meet in Detroit and Snoopy calls the car his whip.
You don't like what I'm saying, you just bounce the fuck up out this whip anywhere along up in here, man.
Okay, I think we're forgetting that this is my whip. Okay. I brought it up. Yeah.
That's a good point, though, because it's hard to choose these characters in a way because so many of the great Leonard scenes involve interplay.
That's right.
And involves two of them.
Yeah, there's some pairing there that needs to go on. But I think what makes him a really memorable character, beyond just being there largely for comedic relief, is what separates him from a character like Snoopy and from the Ordell Robies of the world, which is we learn that Glenn has a conscience. Unlike Jack, who also has a conscience, played by George Clooney, he simply isn't smart enough, though, to get himself out of bad situations he keeps getting himself into. Think about when he's forced by Snoopy to go along on a hit. They're going to murder somebody, and he comes out nauseous, and when he finally gets the chance to get out of this, to get away from Snoopy, it's Karen Sisko, played by Jennifer Lopez, who gives him that out and basically forces him, but he takes it. He doesn't have the stomach for this. And like I said, beyond just being comic relief, I think he actually gives the film a little bit of a moral heft. He's kind of our character. If we were a character in this Elmore Leonard universe, I think we'd be Glenn Michaels.
Oh, don't say that.
We would.
You're probably right.
You do love to wear your sunglasses.
Yes. You mentioned cool heroes. That's what I've got for my number one. Chili Palmer, John Travolta in Get Shorty. I wonder if it maybe took a Hollywood veteran like Travolta. I mean, this was a guy, he'd been burnt and redeemed by the business at this point. And maybe you needed someone like that to capture. It's sort of an enamored type of disrespect that loan shark Chili Palmer brings to Hollywood when he comes there and tries to become a movie producer, because he loves the movies, but he also recognizes this as a shady business, you know, the kind that he's involved in. This was part of Travolta's mid-90s renaissance when things were just really clicking for him, and I do think you sense that movie love in the performance. He has no time for the stupidity of the business, but he wants to make a great film. I think maybe that's why this character in particular, besides the good writing and Travolta himself, but maybe that's why this character struck a chord so much mm-hmm. with audiences.
Now, Martin, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You're an actor. Actors like to pretend, right?
We've been known to make believe.
Pretend this. You're a Shylock.
Mm-hmm.
A guy owes you 15 grand, and he skips town, he takes off. What do you do?
Oh, Martin, for Christ's sake. Just, you know.
I'm doing Shylock instead of a Shylock.
Right.
All right, what's my motivation? The acquisition of money, to collect, to inflict pain if I have to. Guy splits with 15 large of my money. I go after him. What the hell you think I do?
Martin, look at me.
I am looking at you.
Now look at me the way I'm looking at you. Put it in your eyes. You're mine, asshole, without saying it.
Chili Palmer, your number one Elmore Leonard character, also my number one.
All right.
And that scene you just heard where he's talking to Danny DeVito, Martin's motivation. I know it's kind of a cliche, probably, when you think about Get Shorty. There were probably copious Elmore Leonard tributes this past week that all incorporated that clip or referenced that dialogue. And I thought about picking some other scene because there's so many great bits of dialogue and scenes from Get Shorty. But what really struck me, Josh, putting this list together and thinking about what makes an Elmore Leonard character an Elmore Leonard character, is I think that scene actually gives you one Leonard character explaining to another one how to be an Elmore Leonard character. It's an acting lesson, but it also speaks to exactly what makes a cool Leonard character so cool, which is you know exactly who you are, you know what you want. I talked about this a little bit with Charlie Prince, but he's really not that cool. He's just more scary. But you know what you want, and you set about getting it a certain way. You can use force if you need to. Chili Palmer can obviously defend himself, but it's much more about confidence. It's how you carry yourself. And there are so many examples in Get Shorty with Chili, but think about some of his other films. George Clooney robbing a bank and Out of Sight. He just goes up and asks for it. He's charming. He's confident. He knows how to get what he wants. Go back to Ombre, the outlaw character, who's determined to get on the stagecoach. He will get on the stagecoach. There's only one leaving. There are no seats available. So what does he do? He finds that soldier you talked about, Josh, who doesn't have a gun. And he says, I'm going to take your ticket. And he just threatens him with force. He actually doesn't use any force at all. He just threatens him. He's just sure that he's going to get the ticket. And he talks to the guy that way, just like Travolta's talking to Barton there. And he gets what he
wants.
You
know what it is? It's an efficiency. That's what these characters have. And I think of the Chili Palmer scene when he goes to get his jacket back. And the guy who drives them, you know, says, don't be long. He'll say, I'll just do what's needed to be done.
That's it.
And that's all he does.
Yeah. And at one point, I think he's talking to Delroy Lindo's character where he says something about pressure. And he says, pressure, I'm the one who applies the pressure. That's an Elmore Leonard hero, a character who's always in control. Again, understands the rules of the game he's playing better than anybody else and exploits those rules and goes about getting it. Ben Wade in 310 to Yuma. There's no wavering. There's no Glenn Michaels-like doubt about what you're doing. Just going after what you want and getting it. And I think that's what's so interesting is that you get characters like Chili Palmer who are restrained in a way. They're not thugs like some of the villains in some of Elmore Leonard's stories or the movies adapted from them, but they take what they want and they get what they want. And that makes them really fascinating to watch and really cool to watch like Chili Palmer is and Get Shorty. Those are our top five Elmore Leonard characters. What about some honorable mentions, Josh?
Well, you mentioned him, though he wasn't a pick of yours. It's Marshall Sisko, Dennis Farina, and Out of Sight.
So
he's
good.
Got some great scenes. And then a couple here who were the best things about some pretty bad movies, Owen Wilson in the more recent version of The Big Bounce, and Clarence Williams III in 1986's 52 Pickup. He's one of those efficient and scary villains, but sort of a mess of a movie.
Yeah, he is a thug. I mean, he's just going to use physical violence at all times.
He's the muscle.
To get what he wants. My honorable mentions have all been mentioned as well up to this point, but I'll run them off again. Snoopy Miller, Don Cheadle in Out of Sight, Ray Barboni, Dennis Farina in Get Shorty, Jack Foley, George Clooney in Out of Sight, and John Russell, Paul Newman's character in Ombre. I will also mention, ahead of Bobby Shaye, I hate this movie, though it has a warm place in my heart in film spotting history as Be Cool, the sequel to Get Shorty, was the first film ever reviewed on film spotting.
Really?
Yeah, March 6th, 2005.
And you slammed it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Sam and I both were very, very hard on Be Cool because it's a terrible film.
It is
but
pretty bad.
There is a really great Elmore Leonard character in that movie played by none other than Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He plays Elliot,
the gay
Samoan bodyguard slash aspiring actor. The scene with Chili Palmer there, Uma Thurman's watching when he does his monologue that he'd been working up for his audition from Bring It On. That is gold.
Not bad.
And he has many other great scenes like that. And speaking of film spotting history, that whole and scene thing we do from the end of Massacre Theater, that's because of Be Cool. It's because of that scene. So even though I hate the film, I do really like that character.
It's crucial to history,
huh? Mention. It is indeed. We want to know your favorite Elmore Leonard characters or any of the thoughts you have about his work. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release, Ethan Hawke is following the instructions of a mysterious man. He has to save his kidnapped wife. What are you going to do? That thriller is out. It's called Getaway. It also stars John Voight and Selena Gomez. and the Grandmaster, the biopic about martial arts master Ip Man, the man who trained Bruce Lee. It's directed by the great Wong Kar-wai with Tony Leung and Zhang Ziyi. Josh, before we tease next week's show, do you have one movie you'd pick, you recommend for listeners to see this week if they're out and about?
Yeah, I'd probably go back to The Act of Killing. It might be a little bit harder to see. I know it's playing in very limited theaters, but we did the bonus review of it because it just deserves so much time. This documentary in which director Joshua Oppenheimer interviewed genocidal killers, really, from 1960s in Indonesia who are still living there, proud of their crimes, and more than willing to talk about them and recreate some of the killings.
Yeah, as of right this moment we're taping, I don't know that it's going to be held over for another week, but it did stay for a second week at the Music Box, so listeners had a chance to catch up with it after our review. We encourage you to visit the Music Box website for more Showtime information. My pick would be After the Act of Killing, because I'm with you. I probably do ultimately recommend that film more strongly, but if you're looking for a great time that also has, as we talked about, some really, really great insights and truthful, powerful moments, it actually is The World's End from director Edgar Wright, starring Simon Pegg. Really, really good movie. That would be my one pick to see. Next week on the show, we will talk about The Grandmaster. We will also dive into our Korean auteurs marathon. We start with the movie Three Iron from 2005, and we'll share our top five most anticipated fall movies.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.